There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Only four other times in recorded history, and that's only really been back since the 30s and 40s, have we seen this type of outbreak. 530 days. In fact, April 30th was a big outbreak day, so we have to add that into May almost.
So meteorologist Chad Myers talking about the number of tornadoes through the country over the last month. And of course, we're looking at the situation in Ohio right now. 1207, this is FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. I want to point this out because if anybody, right, we got lots of stuff to get to on today's show, but I want to take a second on this tornado stuff. We mentioned it briefly this morning, but I want to dig back into this because right now here's a stat that those of us along the Gulf Coast understand. 50%, as of about an hour ago, 50% of the folks in Ohio do not have power. There were that many tornadoes. Now, when we have tornado stories here in Alabama, there'll be an area, a swath, and they don't have power here or there. Half of the state, the customers in Ohio are without power. And I say that not to take away from the other real destruction, not like, oh, Lord, they don't have electricity. How are they going to make it? It just tells me how much damage must have been done for half of that state to not have power. Now reporting one fatality. Now, it was no fatalities as of this morning. Now, one fatality as tornadoes pass through Ohio and Indiana. The question is, of course, as they do the grisly searches, or the searches, hopefully they don't turn out to be grisly and find human beings. But a story from the AP says a swarm of apparent tornadoes. Oh, come on, AP. I know they haven't done the full on-the-ground work, but I've seen the pictures. That's not straight line winds. But stylistically, they're correct. A swarm of apparent tornadoes so tightly packed that one crossed the path carved by another one tore across Indiana and Ohio overnight. Picture that. Picture that part of it. Storms were among 52 twisters that forecasters say have touched down Monday across eight states, stretching eastward from Idaho and Colorado. The winds knocked homes off their foundations. Now, let's think back to, we have one fatality reported. Hopefully that's it. But think about this path of destruction. Winds knocked homes off their foundation, toppled trees, hurled so much debris that it could be seen on radar. And that's usually, actually, that's, I'll have to point out that that's a signature of tornadoes on radar, right? You can see those debris signatures. And highway crews, this is the one that got my attention. Highway crews in Ohio had to use snow plows to clear I-75. There was so much debris on I-75, a big, it's not like a neighborhood street or something. This is I-75 with the big, you know, divided interstate. And they had to take snow plows to clear the debris so they could use the road. Some of the heaviest damage reported near Dayton, Ohio. This is, just looking at this, thank goodness we don't have more stories of fatalities at this point. Hopefully it does not change from that number of one. But half of the state of Ohio, and I think we can, I mean, I know this is, you know, a long way away from us here in the Gulf Coast, but I think we get it, right? Enough damage that half of the population of a state is without power. So just before midnight, about 40 minutes after a tornado cut through, Weather Service tweeted that another one was crossing its path, churning up enough debris to be seen on radar. That was in Brooksville, west of Dayton, Ohio. The storm tore roofs off schools, destroyed barns, heavily damaged houses. In Dayton, only a few minor injuries reported. Now, they have in some of the pictures of these places where you'll see two tracks, one tornado track, and then you see a, like an intersection with another tornado track. Those poor folks up there, they said many of the roads still impassable in the Dayton area. In Indiana, at least 75 homes damaged. In Pendleton and nearby Huntsville. And like I said, damage all the way back from Colorado and Idaho through Missouri into Illinois, into Indiana and Ohio, and a little bit in Pennsylvania as well, as those tornadoes just pouring through. Enough of them that they were crossing paths with each other. It's just something. 52. This will be yesterday. That outbreak will be a day that, you know, like we have the super outbreak, super tornado outbreak that affected Alabama a couple decades ago. And then one, obviously, after that with the Tuscaloosa tornadoes and all those tornadoes that we focus on the damage in Alabama. But they had damage and I think fatalities in Mississippi and in Georgia from that outbreak. Well, yesterday, one of those days, and or by prayers, I know this, and I think probably a lot of folks here on the Gulf Coast with those people in Ohio. So I know it's a long way away. It's a weather story, but it is just, it is significant. It is truly, truly significant. All right, coming up on today's show, lots to do. In hour number two, you got to hang around for hour number two, or come back and be here for hour number two, because an interview with Jenny Wilkerson, who's assistant professor of pharmacodynamics. It's not a word I say every day. Pharmacodynamics at the University of Florida has a article up that is something that when we've had these discussions of CBD in the past, I've gotten calls and y'all have asked me, well, what do you know about this being used to treat opioid addiction, right? People that are on the opioids, the hydrocodones or whatever. And the questions come up from y'all a lot of times when we had the CBD discussion. Well, now they did the study at the University of Florida and they penned an article about it. And one of those authors, Jenny Wilkerson, is going to join us at 1 o'clock. Very interesting information out here. Scientific double-blind study, not just what you heard from your kinfolk. And she's going to lay out the case there, what they say it can do through their research. So that comes up at 1 o'clock today. We come back here after the break. We'll be joined by Senator Doug Jones, mentioned this morning, that widow's tax story Kelly had in headlines, also the kiddie tax. These are taxes that are a situation where if somebody is receiving death benefits, their loved one, their family member, not their, their family member, served in the armed forces and they have DOD benefits, you know, these death benefits, if they took out insurance policies to protect them further beyond what they would get from the federal government, they're being taxed for the amount that they get from that private. So they spent their money on premiums to have an additional insurance policy. Then that member of the service dies. They are then taxed and had their total from the federal government reduced by whatever they have done on the private sector. It's just, when I first, I had to read the story like three times. I said, well, that can't be right. We're not doing that. Can't be doing that. Well, we are doing that. And what's being done in Washington to hopefully change this very, very quickly. We'll get into that interview when we come back with Doug Jones. And then in the second half of the hour, take a look at Montgomery and what's happening up there right now. As it's basically, yeah, I'd say the last week. I've talked to enough people now. I think it's not officially a quorum of members of the House and Senate in Montgomery, but it sounds like they think Friday is going to be their last day. Usually they gavel in on Tuesday, gavel out on Thursday. They said they're going to keep it going through Friday and shut her down for regular session. Remember, good chance of them coming back in September, October for that special session on prisons. We'll talk about that in hour number, this hour, but second half of the hour. We'll come back, Senator Doug Jones. Y'all stay close.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
And we're joined by Senator Doug Jones here on Midday Mobile. Senator Jones, thanks for your time.
Hey, my pleasure, Sean. Anytime.
Hey, I was wanted to get into the subject. I saw a couple of news stories about it, and of course, with yesterday being Memorial Day, this is so clear and present in the minds of many, and that is a widow's tax and a kiddie tax when it comes to, I guess, spouses of dead service members. Can you explain the situation to us, what we're talking about?
Sure. It's two different things, but they're related. The widow's tax has been in effect since about 1972. It essentially deprives surviving military spouses who have taken out supplemental insurance of the full benefits that they deserve. For instance, right now, surviving spouses have a benefit that's somewhat statutory through the VA and the Department of Defense. What they do, though, is many people take out some supplemental insurance, which they pay for out of their own pocket. But then when it comes time to collect those benefits, the Department of Defense will deduct one from the other. So they're not getting the full benefit of what they paid for. They're getting just the government is just taking money out of their hand. And it's just one of the most unfair things I've ever seen, especially with service members who's given their all. This has cost literally hundreds of millions of dollars probably over the course of 40 years to people that we have an obligation to do. So the bill that I've got in, which now, by the way, Sean, has up to 73 co-sponsors in the Senate, which is pretty amazing given the partisan divide that we've got, 73, including the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, it would eliminate that and allow and require these widows and widowers to get the full benefits that they deserve.
Senator Jones, I don't know that you get 73 members of the Senate to agree it's Tuesday. So, I mean, that's...
it really is pretty remarkable. And these bills, a bill like this has been introduced over the last 20 years. But when this came to my attention a few months ago, really from a surviving widow down in Mobile named Kathy Milford, you know, she came and talked to our office, and we just got engaged in this and put this bill in. Susan Collins is the Republican lead with me on it, and I'm just and our staff have just been working every angle on this to get as many people as possible. And this record number 73, and I think that number is going to grow once we get back up there next week.
Yeah, and it needs to. Just me having basic understanding of what you're describing, it seems like it's truly, like you said, in this case, unfair. So to help me understand, so the individual family takes out a policy, right? And then as they get the return premium on that policy, that's deducted from what they get from the federal government?
That's essentially it. It's a little bit more complicated with some formulas, but that's essentially it. The bottom line is they don't get the full value of what they paid for and what Congress has over a long period of time is it statutorily, that's what we give to family members.
I think there's a lot of people, I know that it's been 20 years of people talking about it, but I think there's a lot of people that are just hearing this for the first time today. They're probably going to be pretty angry this is going on.
Well, they should be. They absolutely should be. I mean, we have a solemn obligation to these families. And we've let them down. We've let them down over a period of 40 years, but certainly with these bills that have been introduced in Congress over the last 20 years and not pushed across the finish line. And that's over the last couple of years, the Gold Star families and others have really gotten engaged more. We have used them. They have stormed the Hill to try to get into the houses, offices of the House members and senators. They've done an amazing job, and I think over the last week or so, we've really done a lot of social media and national media to bring this to everyone's attention so that, you know, members of Congress will know that their constituents think that this is unfair, unjust, and we need to get this changed.
Just joining us, talking to Senator Doug Jones and talking about the widow tax. And specifically, the angle here, I think, is, I mean, it couldn't be more of a story. It's an Alabama story. It's a woman from Mobile that's pushing this now on the widow tax. So, I mean, it's centered right here at home.
It is right there. I mean, Kathy has just done an amazing job. She was up there last week for the press conference that Susan Collins and John Tester and Jim Risch and I did. We did a video that we posted on our Twitter account. From her. She's just an amazing individual. And the companion bill, Sean, that you mentioned is called a kiddies tax.
Okay.
Because what happened is some service members realized what was going on they decided to put their benefits that they were purchasing, they would put them in the name of their children so that they could get the benefits, and those benefits would get taxed at the lower rate from that their parents were being taxed.
Okay.
Well, in the 2017 tax bill, as part of the pay force, because so many of the taxes were being cut, and they didn't want to make sure they had to put some things in there to actually raise some taxes. What happened in that tax bill, they moved the kiddies tax of these veterans over to a huge tax bracket. So instead of having to pay like a 15% tax bracket, they're paying now like 37% tax bracket. And so that is a separate bill that we've done to eliminate the unfair treatment of these service members' children whose names these benefits were in. That passed the Senate unanimously the other day. It's part of a bigger bill in the House. Unfortunately, I think one of my Republican colleagues in the Senate is holding that up right now. But as soon as we get back, we're going to check on that, because that's an easy fix that needs to be done immediately.
Yeah. Once again, on the, like I said, with the widow's tax, I'm sure the same thing, Senator, here on the kiddies tax, that the majority of Americans that don't have this situation, their family, friends, loved ones, didn't know this was a thing. I think people are going to be all around disgusted with this.
No, I agree with you, and that's why I appreciate you calling me and letting me get this word out, because it is such an important thing for our service members right here at Memorial Day. Mm-hmm. You know, I've said consistently, you know, every Memorial Day we honor our fallen, and every Veterans Day we honor our veterans, but we need to be doing that every day, and our actions need to be speaking louder than our words, and I think we can do this with eliminating both of these taxes, this unfair tax on these surviving spouses and the children.
Okay, so let's say both pieces of legislation make it through. Then that family that has the additional insurance premium coming to them will have no effect on their survivor benefits, right, from DOD?
That's correct. They will get the full benefit that they have planned for over the years and done their estate planning. It can be a monthly benefit, an extra monthly benefit for these families who struggle to make ends meet once their family, their service members pass away. We did a roundtable in Birmingham on just the other day, and there was a younger lady who's got four kids whose husband was killed while on duty, killed actually just in a car wreck coming back, and she is struggling. She's having to work two jobs. She struggles because she's not getting those full benefits, which is roughly average is about $1,000 a month. And that's a big deal for so many of these service member families.
You know, you look at, I'm sure, the polling out there on the pulse of the American people, let alone folks right here in Alabama, and the deal we make with our members of the military that go risk their lives and their limb and their mental state, to be frank with you. And, you know, the idea is, will they trade that not just for some competitive rates from USAA? They trade it for these death benefits. They trade it for VA care. That's a whole nother subject. They trade it for security for their loved ones, right? I mean, that is part of the deal.
That is part of the deal, and that is something that we have. It's almost a sacred obligation to fulfill. And you just hit the nail on the head there, Sean. You captured it as well as anybody. We have got this obligation to these members. You know, if we want to honor those folks, we honor their families and their survivors as much as we honor them. And that's what these bills do. I really think people, you know, there will be a cost associated with the widow's tax elimination. But the fact is, they have paid the ultimate sacrifice already. It is up to the American people now to honor our commitment. And it's up to each member of Congress, I think, to do what we can to make sure, because at the end of the day, we've got to encourage people to be in the military. We've got to encourage people to serve. That's one of those things that we have to continue to do to make sure that we have the best and the brightest in our military to go forward to protect this country. This is the least, just the least we can do to help them.
All right. Please keep us in the loop on this legislation as it moves forward, though I feel good about it with that kind of support in the Senate. But you said the kiddie tax, a separate piece of legislation as well, right, to watch?
Absolutely. That one we're hoping to move soon if we can get that hold released. The widow's tax will be a little bit more complicated because of the pay for, but I feel very good about the momentum this year. I think we're going to get this done.
All right, Senator Jones, too, also, if you in the halls of Congress up there, if you do find some unclaimed federal money up there, we're looking for some bridge money down here. So just.
I understand. That's a big issue down there, and we're trying to do everything we can to help. It's a big, big issue. I got it.
All right, Senator Jones, thank you for your time. We'll talk again soon.
You got it, Sean. Thank you.
All right, Senator Doug Jones joining us right here on Midday Mobile. So what do you think about that? Did you know that was even a thing? It was an eye-opener for me. I know not for the Scuttlebutt Boys that do the veteran show every Wednesday here at FM Talk 106.5. Talked to them as well, and they were aware, but I wasn't. And a Mobilian who is the face behind this push. We'll take your calls on this when we get back at 343-0106.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 12:35, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile on this Tuesday. Got a note here from the folks with Auburn. Memorial service for Rod Bramlett is going to be on Thursday at 2. Also looking here on the GoFundMe page. Don't you see how much that's increased? That's good news, and it should go higher. $194,903 of their $250,000 goal. This money is a fund set up for the children of Rod and Paula Bramlett, who in an instant were orphaned. In an instant, didn't have mom and dad. Shelby and Joshua are the children. Shelby, a sophomore at Auburn. Joshua, a 10th grader, will be a 10th grader at Auburn High School this fall. And in an instant, both their mom and dad gone. Right now, I put the link up. We got the link up on the Twitter feed. But if you go to search for GoFundMe and then put Bramlett in or Rod and Paula Bramlett, if you get anything close, it'll take you there. Rod and Paula Bramlett Family Memorial Fund is the full name. And like I said, that link's on my Twitter feed. And by the way, we got a Twitter story about the president in just a second. But you can check it out there. Link through there. But make sure it has a picture of the family standing together. Looks like in the dugout there at Auburn. And you can make your donation there. It says raise about 2,018 people in one day's time did the money raise it that much. That's something. And hopefully it's 250 by the end of this show as you help out those children who, in an instant. I mean, just that, the nature of it gives you, I mean, you got Rod's 50, was 52, his wife was 53. I mean, young folks, you know, that's just both of them. It's unthinkable stuff here. And hopefully we continue to do what's been going on there and give to those children to help get them through what are going to be some very, very hard years ahead. All right. We take a couple more. We got some texts coming in here and some calls if you want to talk about this widow's tax thing. Did you know this was a reality? I did not until I started reading about it over the weekend. So I'm glad something's being done on this. If we're going to lose revenue and tax, that would be a place that I would say you start with the cutting. I like what the president did with tax cuts for middle-class Americans, a lot of folks out there, especially down in our neck of the woods. But I would say even higher up that triage list than all of us are widows and children of service members that died. I think that's should be unspoken. The deal that we cut for people who go risk everything, not just in the shadow of Memorial Day, on any day, that should be an unspoken, that we the people live up to our obligation to them. Which drives me crazy about VA stories, you know, that during the Obama administration, when all the stories, especially here, the ones locally, what was going on here in Alabama just disgusted me, because I see it as a contract. I see as the bureaucracy is, we the people have decided that this is important, and the bureaucracy has failed to do the thing that the promise that we the people made. See what I'm saying? It's almost like I want to look at the veterans and say, I'm sorry, we have incompetence that are running this because we made a deal with you and we're going to live up to that deal. So every time I can push for that, I'm going to do that. All right. Oh, I mentioned the Twitter story. So we got some some Trump talk here. So if you're worried, oh, I hadn't had enough Trump talk today. Well, okay, I'm going to help you get a couple stories. Number one, the story we talked about this morning, the Axios story reflecting on the New York Times commentary. Stephen Ratner, who used to be the car czar for former President Obama, counselor to Treasury Secretary, liberal guy, but obviously a guy who can deal in facts. Which I like. I like if people deal in facts, I can hang out with anybody. And he put out a New York Times commentary where he looked around people that do predictions using models, historically true models. Now, this doesn't mean it happens every time, but almost all the time it happens when these different occurrences happen, economy and incumbency and all that, who wins re-election? Well, three modelers here quoted in this New York Times commentary, Ray Fair, Mark Zandi, and Donald Luskin, all have run models that to them show President Trump winning re-election in 2020. First one is Ray Fair, professor at Yale. He found that the growth rates of the gross domestic product and inflation have been the two most important economic predictors of a president winning a second term. He also found that incumbency was a very important determinant of presidential election outcomes. We figured that one, right? We know the incumbency is powerful. And he says, with this economy, those two things have Ray Fair at Yale saying Trump wins. This is not against any specific Democrat. It's just, does Trump win? It's not like Trump versus, it's not. It's just, will President Trump win? Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, looked at 12 different models on this. 12 different models using different algorithms, plugging in the information, and all 12 times President Trump wins, according to Mark Zandi. And Donald Luskin of Trend Macrolytics reached the same conclusion with his examination of the Electoral College. So he looks at this and says, well, the president's going to win this one. So don't you know that that is got to be ringing in the ears of Democrats that are talking impeachment? It's funny, too. I heard Mike Gallagher come on right after us this morning. Seems like my idea here, I'm not saying they're listening to me, but finally people are arriving at the same conclusion that the Democrats don't want to impeach. They want to talk about impeachment. This is just like the Mueller report. I said the Mueller report was way more valuable when it had not come out for Democrats than after it did. Same thing on this impeachment. The threat of it discussing it, having hearings, because the House, which the Democrats control, could do this at any point. It's not, the House is in control of the Democrats. They could move for impeachment at any point, but they're not. And they'll say, well, it's just, you heard Congressman Byrne on with us last week saying he checked around there and they don't have the votes on the Democrat side in the House to do it. But I would argue that maybe there's some there that will be calling for impeachment but don't want it to happen. At least not yet. They want to hold it back, right, for 2020. I would say, once again, that the president should say, hey, y'all, it's in your hands. You're the ones who decide to impeach. Come on, let's do it. Of course, it would go out of the House, go to the Senate, and the House brings the articles of impeachment. Senate makes a decision, and I don't think the Senate is any threat to impeach the president. But see, the Democrats don't want to go through that. They want to continue to have this thing hanging around out there that they can, threaten. All right. So that's on a couple of the stories on the president. Then this Axios story about the president's tweets. I think this is very interesting. And let me do this for the beautiful irony of this. I will tweet this story out. Headline here, Trump's tweets are losing their potency. Okay. Axios report says President Trump's tweets don't pack the punch they did at the outset of his presidency. His Twitter interaction rate, a measure of the impact given how much he tweets and how many people follow him, has tumbled precipitously, according to data from CrowdTangle. I don't know CrowdTangle. Do you know? To check out who that is. They go on to say why it matters. It's a sign that his strongest communication tool may be losing its effectiveness and that novelty has worn off. President Trump's interaction rate has fallen from 0.055% in the month he was elected to 0.032% in June of 2017, down to 0.16% this month through May 25th. So his interaction rate is dropping. Trump's lines of attacks have been repeated so much that they don't shock anymore, says Toronto Star Washington Bureau Chief Daniel Dale. He says, because norm-breaking tweets become the new norm, Dale says, he doesn't cover them as often, and therefore casual readers hear about them less. Come back here. We'll talk about the pace of the president's tweeting. Is the fact that President Trump tweets so much, uses it as a main communication source, the downfall of it in the first place? And, Dalton, can you see if there's a at real President Trump on Snapchat? Maybe he's going to Snapchat next. All right, coming right back. Grab your calls next.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
At 12:48, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Speaking of Twitter, too, we'll get back into this in a second. If you, hopefully you follow at FM Talk 106.5, that's me on Twitter, but at FM Talk Pods, which is like shorthand for short type, for podcast. Follow that as well, because we talked about the podcast, the 40-some-odd hours a week of live local programming that we do around here at the old radio station. Well, it goes and gets sent to people that subscribe at iTunes or Stitcher or TuneIn Radio or Spotify. You'll get it there. But in addition, if you're looking for just a heads up of what might have happened if you missed a show or whatever, follow at FM Talk Pods, and when we have each hour post, then that'll post to Twitter, and you'll get an idea like, oh, okay, they were talking to Doug Jones, or they were talking to Ben Raines, or they're talking to Bradley Byrne, or whomever, and you want to go back and listen to it, so it'll be a little part of your string there on Twitter. All right, let's go to the phones, and Thomas is in Theodore, and he is first up. Hey, Thomas.
Good afternoon, Sean. Thank you for having me on.
It's good
first
to be here.
First of all, I wanted to tell you, I've had my daughter, because I don't have a computer, vote in Annapolis, and they were only a few days out before they conclude the voting, correct?
That's right, yes. Thank you for reminding me to remind y'all. I'm so bad at this. VoteNappies.com, please, please, please. Five different categories for shows on FM Talk 106.5. We really appreciate your votes. Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you, you have so many duos, the fellows with the coin shop, mm-hmm. Tom and Kale, the Guns and Roses guys, you know, the judge at the Shoot 'em Up show, if I ever heard. And the car show, yeah, I listen to them all. And, boy, Randy Bergen, he is such a nice guy, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
And Danny Spivey, you know, he doesn't tip much, Spivey, but he's a nice guy. He came in fourth in a golf tournament. Anyway, this and your programming. I'm so proud of discovered Clotilda, Ben Raines.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when he came to the city here, Sean, he started, it's a Mike Ward impression, Sean, started writing in the press register. I was so happy. I said, wow, an environmentalist in Mobile? It's unbelievable. Before, we only had Bill Finch talking about his tomatoes. So anyhow, you were saying that these guys are predicting that Trump will win.
Right.
I don't
think used
so.
they used three different. They quoted three in this New York Times article that used modeling that showed, based on this stat, that stat, this stat. You know, they put it in historically that if these things happen, then the incumbent, who is President Trump, would win.
Right. I disagree. I agree with this. We are not going to be in this financial upturn, which we are not in right now. These tariffs, the result of these tariffs hasn't been felt yet. I think we're going to shrink our economy, these tariffs.
You think before November 2020 that would happen?
Yes, yes, absolutely. You see what the farmers are going through. 29, and they're getting killed on this, the farmers. And he's already giving them like 12. He wants another $18 billion to shut them up, you know, so they're not complaining about it. They're getting hurt. There's so many people that are going bankrupt. I think 29 big companies, Sean, Fortune 500 companies, have written letters to Trump and said, we're not going to make it. We're not going to make it.
It's going to be, it's a double whammy here, and I appreciate the call, Thomas, on farmers, and I would talk about this in a future episode or a future segment of the show, because y'all know I like talking about this, but I realize it's not for everybody, but the soybean price, as low as it's gone, this is, I wonder the fact that it's so wet, and this is kind of, I'm sure this is what they're working out at in Chicago at the Mercantile, but because so many farmers can't get in and plant soybeans, Mississippi drainage, I'm thinking about, you know, central United States, those places, because they can't get in to plant beans, will that moderate the price some? In other words, because these farmers can't get in to plant the beans and may not be able to get them until late, and then you get a whole slew of other issues, will it shrink the supply and therefore, you know, it probably won't deal with the trough that we're in, but it will minimize to any degree it can how low the price goes on soybeans. It's a question I don't have an answer to, but it's one I think about when I talk to folks that are west and north of us that are in the soybean ground along the Mississippi River, and they say, hey, you know, I can't get in here and there to plant, and if they can't, it goes too much longer, they're really going to be behind the gun. I mean, they can put beans in June and be okay, but will they be dry by June? Heck, the Mississippi River is just now doing its thing. And yes, I understand there's a levee system and all that before you send your hot text in, so save your fingers. But what happens along the Mississippi River is the bayous and rivers that drain into it have floodgates on them. And when the Mississippi River is flooded, they have to close the floodgates. When they close the floodgates, the water locally that falls cannot get out because the floodgates are closed, and therefore the water backs up on the other side of the levee and keeps people from being able to farm. All right, so just save the text message. All right, back to this Twitter story. All right, so I think it's, they show the fall of the Twitter interaction rate for President Trump. Go on to say here that the premise of the article from Axios, from Neil Rothschild, is that the president has tweeted so much that it's jumped the shark, right? That he's done so much tweeting that it's not getting the attention it used to. There might be truth to that. It says, since April 1st, President Trump has tweeted about no collusion 54 times, no obstruction 30 times. I wonder, come on, those are usually the same tweet, right? There's no collusion, no obstruction, or no obstruction, no collusion. They're usually the same tweet. Witch hunt 20 times, hoax 19 times, radical left Democrat 17 times. That's it? Only 17 times? That seems like he's missing a mark there. 13 or 18 angry Democrats, 12 times. Presidential harassment, 10 times. Treason, 7 times. Goes on to say that while the number of interactions per tweet Trump generates has increased 21% between his first 6 months and his most recent 6 months, it lags way behind his follower growth of 110%. It's like reading through the stats. This is why you can have spurious correlations as well. You have Neil Rothschild, and everything that I'm guessing he lists here is factual. These things are factual. But then he goes on to make an assumption of what it means. You can only grow, it says, you know, he was growing at 110%. Now he's way behind that. Because you saturate. Eventually, you saturate. I think that's why that's not been taken into this Axios story. I don't know. Says the president is now tweeting more than ever. The pace of President Trump's tweeting has picked up over the course of his presidency from 157 times a month during his first 6 months to 284 times per month over the last 6 months. May is on pace to be the lowest month for Trump's Twitter interaction rate since January of 2016. Not counting the posts he retweets, he's at 343 tweets through May 25th, closing in on his one-month record of 348 in August. All right, this is what I thought was interesting in the story as well. When he took it by the numbers, though, he said, President Trump's top tweet of his presidency. What do y'all guess it is? Dalton, I'll let you make your guess. Everybody listen. The number one tweet from the president. Y'all got your idea? Everybody got their answers? All right, it is that wrestling video, the pro wrestling video with, remember, it's got the president in there, photoshopped on the wrestler, taking down the other wrestler with the CNN logo for the head. That one had 930,531 interactions. Not bad for a tweet. Number two and number three would be both insults and threats to Kim Jong-un.
The insults, 876,755 interactions. The threats to Kim Jong-un, 685,193 interactions. Number four, I don't know what they're how they're going to deal with this in CNN or even maybe Axios to some degree. Number four, biggest tweets for the president, Merry Christmas. How about that? And number five, good morning and have a great day. Merry Christmas got 592,052 interactions. Have a great day got 538,564 interactions. So there you go. That's the top five biggest tweets of the president. But there may be some truth to that. If there's a tweet every few minutes from the president, maybe it doesn't make the noise that it did when he first showed up and he changed things, right? He changed things. He didn't have somebody tweeting before like that. And the president rolls in and starts tweeting and it's new. It's different. It's man bites dog, right? It's more interesting. And you're like, oh, wow, look, we have a president who's tweeting all the time. We can get his thoughts on this and that. And after a while, I wonder if it just becomes commonplace and starts to be yesterday's news. Like I said, President Trump, Snapchat, man. Isn't that what the kids are doing? President Trump on Snapchat. Just an idea. All right. Hey, coming back after top of the hour news, this is an interview that I've wanted to do since we started talking about CBD, and I started getting questions from y'all about CBD helping with opioid addiction. Jenny Wilkerson from the University of Florida joins us next to talk about that. Y'all stay close.